Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, good afternoon, God bless. Welcome to Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom. I'm Beverly Black Johnson, the creator of Tribe Family Channel, and I want to welcome you to our Season 3 opener of Voices of Wisdom, stories told by and about seasoned generations of history tellers speaking wisdom and shedding light on life. Today's guest is the moderator of Season 3, Voices of Wisdom, Mr. Mike O'Brien, and his guest we will introduce shortly. But first, we want to bring Mike on the line and get him familiar with our listeners. Hi, Mike. How are you this evening?
Hi, Beverly. Just fine. Happy to be here.
And we are so thankful and grateful that you could take out time not only to be with us, but to share your work and to moderate Season 3. So on behalf of myself, Gumbo for the Soul International, Tribe Family Channel, and Mr. Bruce George of Bruce George Media, the producers of Tribe Family Channel want to give you a great big thank you and a warm, you know, note of gratitude. We appreciate your time.
Just thrilled to be here.
Great, great. So we're going to start by letting our audience get to know you. Tell us where you're from.
Well, you know, I'm originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I like to say my family came to Washington, D.C. with the Kennedys. We moved here in November of 1960, just as John Kennedy had been elected to the presidency. My dad moved down to Virginia to take a job with the government. So I came down here when I was eight or nine years old, and have been pretty much here ever since, with a few little stints here and there.
Oh, okay. And how are you enjoying still being there?
Well, it's quite the place, especially right now. I mean, it's really the center kind of the political world, and you know, it's gradually become that over the years. It was kind of a sleepy town when we first got here, but boy, with the I guess with the meltdown of the economy and the input of the federal government's, you know, funds, it's become quite the mecca for, you know, contractors, and of course all the political shenanigans that are going on now. So it's quite the place to be, and there's also a lot of cultural and wonderful, you know, research opportunities here, which I'm happy to be here for that purpose for my work.
Absolutely. I was amazed that one of my clients, Colonel Richard Tolliver, just had a book signing at the Pentagon in Washington. And I was like, whoa, okay, you don't get any books any better than that. So tell us, what field of work, what field of study did you go to school and university for?
Okay, so in the late 60s and early 70s, I was actually considering becoming a Catholic priest. My family was, raised me Catholic, and that seemed like an interesting. I was very kind of sensitive and spiritual, and wanted to explore that. So I actually went away to high school and college to a Catholic seminary. But by the end of my senior year in 1973, I decided the world was kind of becoming a much more interesting place at that time, and lots of movements were exploding all over the place. And I felt I had a little bit too much shelter in the seminary and wanted to get out and explore the world. So I left that in 1973. That was St. Mary's Seminary College in Catonsville, Maryland, that I went to initially for college, and graduated from there in 73. That was actually, just for your listeners, interest, the seminary from which the Berrigan brothers launched their draft board action back in 1968. I happened to go to that seminary the very next year, so it was quite a hotbed of, you know, kind of political activism, and that's kind of where I began really to develop an interest in these issues. While I was there, I marched with Cesar Chavez when he marched from Baltimore to Washington and you know, demonstrated in front of the Department of Agriculture for the migrant farm workers. So, so really, the spiritual underpinnings of my interest in activism began at that seminary at St. Mary's. But when I left in 73, I kind of bounced around a little bit and then got a second degree in communications and journalism from the American University here in Washington, D.C. And that really put me on the path of, you know, focusing on writing and, you know, attempting to document some of these, you know, demonstrations and activities that I had, you know, heard about and learned about in my youth.
And that's what I was going to ask you as far as your field of work. Now, we know that you, you know, got your journalism there and then, but you did about 30 years of work in another area of industry. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't, I try not to separate it too much because I think it all has, is all of a piece. So I did, in fact, go to work for a not-for-profit cooperative. And I know that probably many of your listeners are not familiar with the cooperative business model, but it's one that is much more democratic. It's not really for-profit. I say it's not-for-profit. It's for people. It's run by the people that the organization is serving. And the cooperative that I was working for was a large one. It was to provide funding to all of the electric cooperatives all over the country that help serve electricity to, you know, the millions of consumers in rural areas of the United States. So so I got exposed to, which in fact at the time was a pretty radical idea when these cooperatives were forming in the 30s and 40s. It stands up against the yeah, I guess you'd say the capitalist system as a different approach to, you know, to having business and helping people. So for 30 years, I worked for this organization called the Cooperative Finance Corporation, or CFC, and I was their, you know, public relations official and speechwriter, and you know, we put on meetings all over the country, invited big name speakers to educate our members about what was going on in the world politically and environmentally. So it was a great career, but all the while I was also kind of in the background working on this book project, which I know we're going to talk about in a minute.
Right, right. And, you know, with the background in seminary and the background with the nonprofit cooperative, that kind of gave you some of the undergirding for working in advocacy, because you do have to have a center and a higher, you know, a center, a focus, a God in your life. And, you know, to work in nonprofit, in the nonprofit sector, excuse me, you know, you have to generally be concerned about people and their well-being on a global scale, not just, you know, your own home and your own family. So I can see how you would be doing the work that you're doing today from the undergirding of your education and your early beginnings. So, yeah, we're going to talk about your book, As the Earth Shall Not Be Moved. What prompts you to write this book?
Well, there were a couple of things, Beverly. First of all, when you talk about, you know, family and the undergirding of what moved me towards this focus, I should mention, too, that my wife and I adopted three African-American children in the 90s, you know, during the horrible crack epidemic that really hit D.C. very hard. There were thousands of children that were left, homeless or, just uncared for because of that. So we did, in fact, because of our beliefs, we took in these children and have had a wonderful time with them and have made a wonderful family of it. So that all kind of ties in too to my interest in civil rights. The way that this book really came about was actually way before any of that happened. In the 70s, after I graduated from the seminary, I took a job as a playground counselor at a local neighborhood playground, at the school playground. In the summers, they would have a summer program. And these five boys came running across the field and into my life, and they happened to be the children of one of the civil rights activists from Jackson, Mississippi in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And I became friends with the kids and then friends with their mother. And she was a white Southerner who got involved from the very earliest days of the student movement in the 1960s. And I found her story so compelling and so unusual that I just, over the years determined that this was a story that had not been told. And since I hadn't heard about it, I figured most people hadn't. And what the kids would always do, they would pull out this photograph and say, "My mom's in a famous picture." And I would, look at the picture, and it was a very compelling one. It was, their mom sitting at a lunch counter with a black woman and another white man, with all these kids throwing on, ketchup and mustard and sugar on the back of their heads. And I didn't realize at that time how important that moment was and that picture was for the civil rights movement. But it was not until 15 years after I first encountered those kids that I was in Atlanta for work and went down to the King Center just to visit and, to see what it was all about. And in a small room off to the side was a whole big group of photographs, mostly of Dr. King and all of his wonderful work in the civil rights movement. But in that room was this photo that the kids kept telling me about, and I was shocked to see it there, and I realized, whoa, this is not just a scrapbook memento. This is a major moment in the civil rights movement, and if I don't really understand how important this is, but it happens to be here at this museum, I'm guessing that most people don't realize the story behind this photo. So it was really from that moment in 1992 that I decided this story needed to be told, and I had a unique opportunity to tell it because I knew the woman at the center of the photograph.
Wow. That is something. Now, the other day I asked you if you knew the author of A White Man's Journey Through Black History, a presentation by Dr. Joel Freeman. And to that, I would ask you to describe what is your personal journey and how it has affected you from a non-black perspective, just like, you talked about adopting black children and, growing up and what have you. But have you had to personally experience any type of segregation where, you were, directly there and just experience any racism or any of that from a white man's journey through black history?
Well, from a personal perspective, it's interesting to me because those questions do come up in my own mind, and now, that the book is out and I'm more of a public figure, these questions come up publicly as well. Like, what is it that attracted you to this subject matter as a white person? I grew up in the 50s. I came of age in the early 60s and saw all of this drama around race, right? I mean, luckily, I went to Catholic schools my whole life, and the Catholic Church somehow was able, in most cases, to integrate their churches and their schools in ways that, you know, public schools didn't. So in Philadelphia, of course, those schools were integrated long before I started going to school. So it was a natural thing to go to school with black kids there. And then when I came to Virginia in 1960, I think it could have only been a year or two before I got there that, or maybe it was actually that year that the Catholic schools integrated. Because I recall, you know, I went to school with black kids in Virginia as well because it was a Catholic school. But I do recall that, you know, there were these kind of hushed discussions in the hallway by the nuns about, you know, different black students. And it seemed as though, now looking back on it, that maybe this was kind of a new thing for them to have black students in the schools. So I never really... What's that?
I said culture shock.
Culture shock for them. Yeah, right, right, right. But I never really had that, the shock that perhaps like Joan Trumpauer, the woman I was referring to 10 years earlier had, you know, because she grew up in segregated Virginia and just kind of accepted it for what it was until she had kind of a culture shock herself. So I think it was more the fact that it was a drama for the adults, and I was looking at it and saying, well, I don't really understand what the problem is here. And I really got into, in my early teens and late teens, I really got into black music. I just loved Motown and soul and, you know, James Brown and Aretha Franklin and Diana Ross, all that stuff. I was like, this is great. And I loved to dance, even though I was in the seminary. I just, you know.
Shaking your groove, eh?
I did. You know, I just thought this was the greatest. It was so lively and so, it had such energy that even I didn't think rock and roll had. It had something better than that. So, so that really attracted me to the black experience. Actually going to school in Baltimore, you know, it was an urban center, and I did get to see kind of the inequities economically between kind of like where blacks typically lived and then where, of course, we were up on a hill, you know, in a beautiful section of outside of Baltimore at the seminary. But we did have projects where we would go in, you know, because we were studying for the ministry, and we would go in and work with people. I worked with some young kids who, you know, just needed a little tutoring, but we worked in the black section of town. And then later I worked with women, alcoholic women at a halfway house. You know, many of them were also black. So I had experiences with black culture and began to see, you know, firsthand some of these inequities that were existing in our even in our northern culture.
All right. So tell us about the Lillian Smith Award you recently won and the significance of it.
Oh, wow. Well, that was just such an honor. I don't think many people today know the name of Lillian Smith, but she was a writer, a white Southern writer from the 30s, 40s, and 50s who, you know, just was able to deconstruct the whole segregationist model that she grew up in and try to tell particularly whites the evils of segregation, not only the evils of how it impacted the black community, but how it affected the white community and the psychology of it, and particularly how it affected white women. So she wrote some wonderful books, one called Killers of the Dream, which really is a psychological kind of deconstruction of segregation, but also one called Strange Fruit, which is a novel which goes into, which was one of the best books of 1944. best-selling books, and it was the story of an interracial love affair and how that played out in the segregated South. So anyway, she was a real role model for a lot of the early civil rights students who got involved in the 60s. And this award was named after her death. She died in 1966, and the award was started in 68 by a group called the Southern Regional Council, which itself is almost ready to celebrate its 100th anniversary of attempting to, you know, advocate for progressive change in the South, particularly around racial issues. So to get this award from that organization and with Lillian Smith's kind of stamp of approval is just a wonderful thing that I could never have anticipated during the 20 years I was working on this book in my basement.
Well, congratulations to you for this wonderful award. And in my research, just finding out about the Lillian Smith Award and, you know, what the significance of it all entails, I found it pretty fascinating that it, you know, centered around those that depict the South and the way it was and the, you know, the fights and the struggle. And I thought that was a very interesting honor to put out there, to have people preserve history. If you were writing in this area and in this arena, to be honored in this way is wonderful, and it's very unique to me. So now you're writing a prequel to We Shall Not Be Moved, which focuses on the 209 library sit-in staged by the 209 college students back in the early 60s. And we have with us today one of the 209, Ms. Geraldine Hollis. Welcome, Ms. Geraldine. How are you?
Thank you. I'm just great. Wonderful. Thank you for the introduction.
Well, it is an honor, privilege, and pleasure to have you on Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom. And as we previously stated, Mike O'Brien is the moderator of Season 3. So at this point, now that we all know a little bit more about Mr. O'Brien, or Mike, if you will, I am going to step back and give him the microphone and allow him to let us know about you and your work and your book, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right,
thank you.
So you've handed off the baton, Beverly, and I'm going to just grab it and run with it. I'll just say that the book that you mentioned, We Shall Not Be Moved, actually focuses on a demonstration that happened 2 years after the 209 library sit-in that Geraldine participated in. But and it's famous for many reasons, but one reason is the famous photograph that now has become iconic and really kind of represents kind of everything that was going on in Mississippi at the time. So I really started my book thanks to, you know, Joan Mulholland, who's at the center of that photograph. But I did mention in the kind of background of what was going on in Mississippi this other demonstration that happened 2 years earlier called the 209 Library Sit-In, or that's what it's come to be known as, that our guest Geraldine participated in. And my interest in this demonstration, and it's really going to be the subject of my next book, is that it was really the very first student demonstration that took place within the state of Mississippi. And I think most people realize that the student movement began on February 1st, 1960, when the sit-ins erupted in Greensboro, North Carolina. Well, it took a whole year and a couple of months before those sit-ins came to Mississippi, largely because of the repressive regime that was in place there. And Geraldine knows an awful lot about that. So maybe, Geraldine, we can start off just by talking a little bit about your background. And I know you've written yourself a couple of books about your experience not only at the library sit-in, but about your early growing up. So maybe you just want to tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came up.
Okay. Now, I really enjoyed hearing you give your overview of your life growing up.
Uh-huh.
My life was really very different. Really, it was good in many ways. I grew up with a extended family for the most part, and my parents were married at an early age, and we got to live with my grandparents and an aunt and cousins. So it was a nuclear family, not unlike some of the families now, but very different from many, many families, because we had a head of the family, which was our grandfather, and my grandmother, who was a very outgoing person and a very giving person. I do believe that in my writing, I shared that a lot of things that I learned about life, I learned from my grandmother about living in the community and giving to the community and working with people, because this is what she did. However, what happened is that my town that I lived in, the town that I was born in before I moved to Mississippi, was a town that was moved from the river back over into the north part of the town, the area. And this, the nuclear of the town in the center, was where all of the white and the businesses, all of these areas were located right in the center of town. And that made the blacks have to build their homes out on the outskirts, on the north side and the south side,
mm-hmm.
either uptown or downtown. But in the big thing that I wanted to share, because it was all about school for me also, in order to get to school, I lived on the north side of town. And at that time, going to school as a young girl, 6 and 7 years old, I had to walk all the way through the white part of town, crossing the highway that divided the north and the south, and go many other blocks to get to school. And that was on the south side of town. Now, if you would remember, there are schools that were inside of that nuclear, schools that were only for the whites. And another thing that was a very big discrimination for me, and I realized this very early in life, when they got to the edge of the area where the whites lived and the blacks began to live, there were no more sidewalks. No more sidewalks. Sidewalks were all over the town where the whites lived. But any time that you passed that area, there were ditches and pathways that were muddy. The ditches carried the wastewaters through a channel system to the river. And this made a big difference for a person like me. And I say a person like me because I've always been active. And even at a young age, I could tell that there were differences. Before I went to school, I knew that there were differences because I couldn't go into the soda shop or the pharmacy where the ice cream was sold and sit down at those little wire chairs that the other little girls of another culture could sit down. And so I had to go over to the side of the counter and purchase what I wanted, and then I had to leave out of the place. So I remember that very, very vividly.
Yes, and the sidewalks, I know in your writing, and you've written a book, your memoir, Back to Mississippi, even in on the cover, it mentions those sidewalks. And it
yes.
says, sidewalks represent a journey to the paths of my success, right? Follow my steps and take the journey. Those sidewalks meant so much to you, I guess, as a young girl, maybe even, you know, was it not just because you could see the stark differences, they had sidewalks in the white area but not in the black area, but I would think even from a safety perspective, walking all the way to school when there's no sidewalks, it makes it more complicated, difficult, and maybe even dangerous to get to school.
That is so right, Mike. Really was different, and it was difficult. Rainy weather, there was only rocks, gravel in the roads. If cars came along, you had to move over towards the ditch. The water that traveled through the ditches was very high during rainy season. If you slipped in, you could have drowned. It was just that they were just that deep.
Yeah.
And it was not safe. So really the sidewalks made a big difference. I looked at those sidewalks and it let me know that in order to be successful, you need to know where the sidewalks are going.
Right. So when that was in Louisiana, right, that you originally started school, but then you did move eventually to Mississippi. What was that like?
That was almost the same in terms of those sidewalks. I lived on the side of the north part of the Natchez area, and I had to walk all the way through the white area and cross over to the east side of the town, and there were sidewalks again. So sidewalks made a big difference in me, and one of the reasons, too, is because, like I said, I was very active. And one of the things that I remember getting for a present was skates. I would see other children, other nationalities. You know, it was only basically white only and blacks at that time, the majority of the people in the towns.
Sure.
But I would see them on the skates, and, of course, I wanted some skates, but I couldn't skate in my neighborhood. So that was a big problem. I had to leave my neighborhood and go into the white neighborhood and in order to be able to skate.
Because they had the sidewalks and the streets.
They had sidewalks.
Yeah.
And they also had asphalt in the streets.
Right.
And sidewalks on the side. In my neighborhood, there were only gravel and muddy pathways or dusty pathways.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, that made it.
So how did that make you feel as a young girl? What did you learn from that?
It let me know that I was not equal. I had some things that, for me, it challenged me to want to be able to do those things, to be able to be the same as anybody else. And I did enjoy being active. I did enjoy having the idea of being able to do the things that were normal for other children. But for me, I had a problem with that when I could not do these things.
Sure. And so let's fast forward then. You make it into I don't want to go too fast, but I know our time is limited, so I want to make sure we get to Tougaloo College and the demonstration that you end up being at the center of. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about how you got to Tougaloo and a little bit about the college itself and what it meant to you to be there.
Okay, again, Mike, I sent around for some information about colleges, and when I got the book for Tougaloo, I think that one of the things that they had a outline of the gate there, and it looks like it had trees and things all around. And I did have some neighbors who had were attending Tougaloo when I graduated, so I knew that they were there. So just as a chance, I asked my parents to let's go ahead and look at Tougaloo. I did turn in the applications before I finished, but I wanted to make sure because I had a choice of going to Natchez College or Alcorn, and I wanted to see what Tougaloo was like. So we went there, and I walked over the campus, and I found it to be almost a different environment from the one that I lived in. When I got to Tougaloo, and not only were there sidewalks that directed you everywhere, but there were faculty, and even in the summertime, there were people of different nationalities on the campus from other countries. And I guess they had quite a few international students. The faculty was from places like Germany, France, Costa Rica, just a lot of places. And so I knew then that this was a place that was not the ordinary type of a place. It seemed like it really gave me something to motivate me to see that I could get to the place that I wanted to in life. And I think that's why in my book I wrote that the sidewalks are those things, those steps, those journeys that made it possible for me to see that I could be successful in life.
Yes, and you even have a picture of Tougaloo College on the cover, right, with the sidewalks, and that meant so much to you to finally arrive at a place that had sidewalks.
That's right. Not only have sidewalks, we had sidewalks to direct you everywhere you wanted to go.
Right. So this, we can just clarify a little bit that you mentioned a couple of colleges that you had options to go to. Alcorn was a state, school, right? Historically black, but a state-run school. Natchez, I think, was a Baptist school, perhaps very small, but in your hometown.
Yeah.
And then
it
Tougaloo
was
an independently run. Also run pretty much by a church school. I think the United Church of Christ was their sponsor.
Right. At that time, it was called Tougaloo Christian College.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it has a chapel right at the center of a campus, right?
It really does. That is one of the historical sites on campus, the Woodworth
Chapel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
But you felt that you had kind of found your element at Tougaloo. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about kind of the culture, the student body, the camaraderie that you found there.
Very accommodating. As I said earlier, when I got on the campus for that first time to look around, we were paired with students who were there for the summer, and those students mostly were international students, but they were black or they were brown, different other colors. They weren't just all African-Americans.
Uh-huh.
And I got paired with a young man that was from Panama Canal Zone, the Americanized area, and not only was he very verbal, but he was telling me about himself and told me how he stayed at Tougaloo all summer, all year, and that he could go to school. And he was a physical education major, which I had intended to be. And at that time, he just shared all of the things that he was doing, and he shared with me his plan. And it just felt so really right, because this was some of the things that I thought that I wanted to do also. And listening to him, and with him telling me all of the things that I could do, he shared all of the buildings. He shared with me the classes that he attended, prerequisite classes and the regular classes that I would have to take. And it was really just a great journey, just listening to him and to see that he came all the way from Panama, and he felt very comfortable being at Tougaloo and at ease, and he had no problems at all. And, of course, he just shared all of these things, and it just gave me the confidence that, I can do this too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great. And so you had, it sounds like, you know, your journey to Tougaloo sounds so much like so many young people who are looking for just the right place for them. And then when they find it, something clicks, right? And they just know this is going to be the right place for them. My daughter just went through that a few years ago, and we went all over the place, including Spelman College, which I thought she was going to love, and she ended up at a whole different place, but it was really the right place for her. So I think every student has their own, you know, journey to take, and you ended up at Tougaloo. But the reason that we're talking is that not only did you end up at Tougaloo, but after you were there for a while, you got involved with some students who were interested in trying to make things better for all Black people in Mississippi. Maybe you can tell us a little bit of how you began to run in that circle.
Okay. I do believe that one of the things that I tried to bring in before we got this far was that there were professors from all over. Okay,
right.
We had a professor whose name was Dr. Barinsky. He had a very heavy accent, but he had a lot of wisdom. And on the back of my book, On Back to Mississippi, that's the dormitory that I stayed in, and it was Jameson Hall. Very next door to that was the sociology department at the bottom of the building. That building now has been torn down and rebuilt as the
Benny Thompson, right?
The Benny Thompson, and that's a very big historical building now. But at that time, we had that sociology lab, and every Wednesday night, there were forums where all kinds of individuals in the community, those that were working with civil rights or just talking about activism or community work in any way. And they would come to the campus there and we would listen to them. We had some professional people. We had those from the Congress and just about every caliber of person that you could ever think of that wanted to come and engage with students. They were welcome to the forums and come in and talk with the students, and it was a great gathering place for us. So it was during those talks at the forums that I really got involved with knowing that there was a way that we could make a difference.
So right. As I recall, people like James Baldwin was a visitor on campus once at the forum. Ralph Bunch, who was the first American Black to be undersecretary to the United Nations. You know, some very, very prominent people. Who Dr. Barinsky, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany, right? He was from, I think, the kind of Polish border area of Germany.
It was in that area, yes.
Had come to this country and decided that he wanted to help America deal with its racial problems because he had experienced firsthand as a Jew, you know, what it was like to be on the other end of, you know, white supremacy. So he came to Tougaloo and really made it his life's mission to work with Black students and to really try to find ways to actually, he was hoping for a peaceful, transition, and it didn't unfortunately happen that way in Mississippi. But you are right. There are many, many students from Tougaloo who were influenced by Dr. Barinsky. In fact, he is buried on the Tougaloo campus. That's how dedicated he was to that college. And so you started to get involved, and then let's jump to the actual sit-in that you participated in, which now has become known as the Tougaloo 9 Library Sit-in. Who are the Tougaloo 9, and what was the idea behind having a sit-in at a library?
Okay, first of all, There are 9 of us who actually went into the library, but there were more students that were involved in the process. The 9 of us who went into the library are Alfred, Albert
Lassiter.
Yes, that was James Bradford, Meredith, and then Joseph Jackson, and the girls were Pierce, who was Dr. Omar later, and Ethel Sawyer,
mm-hmm.
Janet Jackson, and myself, Geraldine Edwards at that time.
Right, and did you mention Alfred Cook, too?
I did say Alfred, but Alfred
Cook.
Yeah,
Alfred Cook was the other one. So that's the 9, right.
Yes.
And so tell us about this was like the first major demonstration in the entire state of Mississippi. This was an incredible thing that you all did in that horribly repressive environment. So tell us about kind of the workup to that and how did it all come about?
Well, it really was the very first and successful event to happen in Mississippi. It didn't happen overnight. A lot of people thought maybe we just sort of got together and did some things. But this was a process, and we went through some training, some skills. We got through some, attitudinal type things to find out who had the temperament to deal with the nonviolence that we knew that we had to have.
Mm-hmm.
And we did work on some of those skills with each other as a group, trying to make sure that all of us knew how to be nonviolent. And this was the real essence of what we wanted to do. We didn't want it in any way to be violent. So we had to really work with that. So that made a big difference in who was chosen and who was not chosen. And I'm not sure if that criteria was written down somewhere. I know that there was criteria, but in essence, we had to be nonviolent, and this was the stress of everything that we had to do to make that choice of what we wanted to do. I do believe that it was something that was given out there, the kinds of things that we could do, and we knew already those kinds of things that had already happened in the states just north of us in Tennessee and Virginia and Arkansas. So we knew some of the things that had already happened. So somehow
yes.
It came up.
These things were beginning to happen all around Mississippi, but nothing had yet happened within the state, right?
Right.
And so you all had started talking like, well, why isn't anything happening here? Maybe we should, take this on as our mission. And let me bring in one other name that I think most of the listeners would be familiar with, and that is the name of Medgar Evers, the NAACP field secretary in the state of Mississippi. Perhaps you can just talk about Medgar's involvement in the planning.
Megger was the field secretary. He was a very hardworking and a very convincing young man. And we knew that he was very serious. That was the one thing that we knew about him. He was concerned, he was serious, and he was supportive in every way. He wanted to make sure that what we did, we were safe, that we were knowledgeable of what we had to do. And he was not there all of the time on top of us. We had a on-site advisor that was Dr. John Mangrum, Reverend Mangrum.
Reverend Mangrum, who was the chaplain of Tougaloo, right?
He was the chaplain, yes. So that was the other adult person that we worked with. But Mangrum was just such an outstanding, outgoing, and believable person. And we knew that he had a lot of things that he was doing. Some of the students that we had working with us were a part of the youth NAACP before they came to Tougaloo.
Uh-huh.
And this made a difference also. I do believe that you'll find that out later talking with some of the others, that they were already involved with some of the things that had to do with making a difference in Mississippi and change agency.
Right. So they were part of the youth chapters of the various without through in the state of Mississippi. So right. And so we only have about 5 more minutes, so maybe we ought to get actually to the library. Tell us, maybe you can tell us what it was like for you to walk into that library for the first time, the white library, knowing that you were breaking the law.
Yes. Knowing that I was breaking the law, knowing that I did not have any protection other than myself, I knew that I had the opportunity to do this, but how would I get through this successfully, but being determined to know that I really wanted to be a part of making a difference with this particular example of going into that library. Perhaps at another time we can talk about how we prepared for going into the library. But one of the things that I remember is that I knew that I had to dress warmly for the weather. I had to dress so that if I got blows on me, that I would not have all of my body exposed. I had a hat on. I had a raincoat. I had on comfortable shoes that I could run in. I really was dressed in layers because you never knew what the weather was going to be like. So being prepared.
Yes, and this was late March, right? So it was still
yes,
changeable, the weather, yeah.
Yes. So we didn't know just how the weather would be, but I wanted to make sure that I was ready for that. Going into the library, it was one of those things where you start to know that your body is going inside, but you're not sure just where your mind and your feelings are because you have to hold everything in. I remember holding myself in. I just wouldn't let myself feel. I just knew that it was like the robotic type thing. My body was moving. I had a purpose. I had a reason to be there. I knew that reason. And so I walked in knowing that I was doing something that was against the law at that time.
And that was so totally against the way you were raised, right? To do something that was totally against the law.
It was uncalled. It was unheard of. You just didn't do things. Put yourself in a place where you knew you would go to jail.
Right. So this was going against everything you had been taught. But you did it. And what was it like being in that library? What did you do? How did it turn out?
Well, the results say that it turned out really great,
mm-hmm.
but it was a challenge to be in there. However, we had to prepare for that challenge by getting the books that would give us a right to be inside of the library. We knew where all of the books and the references and everything that was in the library was. Although we'd never been in there, we knew how to find everything to maneuver about the library. We were told that we were not in the right place, but we had an answer for that, too, because we couldn't find the books that we were looking for in the colored library, and this gave us a very good excuse to be in that white-only library.
Right. You guys had gone to the Carver Library, the black library, and, of course, they didn't have the books you were looking for. So you came to the white library looking for that book. So it was really a challenge to the separate but equal myth that had been propagated there in the South.
That's correct. It was not equal. And that was what we lived with, so many of us, with degraded materials and educational things that we needed to help us to be better, books and things that we had, the libraries in our hometowns, many things were just inadequate. They were secondary. They were degraded. And so, yes, we needed to be able to make a statement with this. And that's
right. So then you're in there and you're looking through the card catalog. You find the book that you're looking for, and then the police come. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. The police came, and we were prepared for that, too. We didn't get excited. We just took our time And we got up and we were compliant. We were just as cooperative as we could be because we had made our statement. We found the books that we wanted to read, and we sat down, most of us, and started reading those books or looking at some for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people will ask, how did we feel? I was numb. I remember that I was like in a fog for some of that time because I just couldn't deal with my feelings. And so I was sort of having something like an outer body experience. Was this really me inside of this place? Was this somebody else? But it was me. I was there. And I'm so happy that it was documented and it was done, and it has been a change agent for the state of Mississippi and in the library system there in Jackson.
Absolutely. Well, I hope maybe we're going to have another chance to talk more, Geraldine, because it looks like we've just about run out of time, and I know we want to invite Beverly back in, but we've only scratched the surface because we have to talk about how you got to jail, what happened in jail, what happened after all that. So there's a lot more to talk about, and maybe we'll have another chance to do this on our next segment. So, Beverly, you want to come on back in and wrap it up?
Absolutely, absolutely. I do want to thank both of you for such a profound and enlightening discussion. I don't want to call it an interview, and I definitely want to invite you back on October the 16th to continue the discussion, if, you know, schedule permits for both of you. But that would be the time for us to definitely delve into a deeper understanding of what I like the way Geraldine is going into what it took to prepare, you know, mentally, physically, and being numb there. And that is so profound, what you just said, Ms. Collins. It was me.
Go ahead, Geraldine, you first.
Yeah, go ahead, Geraldine.
www.backtomississippi.com, and on Facebook it is Back to Mississippi and March Memories.
Right, Geraldine has two books, right? March Memories is really focused on the sit-in itself, right?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Well, perhaps we can also, you know, take time and even extend the show so that we can delve deeper on our next segment. And, Mike, where can people find you?
So I'm on, my book is called We Shall Not Be Moved, and the website is notbemoved.com. So I've got a blog there, and actually even an email if people are interested, and that's simply notbemoved.com@verizon.net. So I made that Not Be Moved as part of my, you know, logo.
Exactly. Well, thank you once again for sitting down and having this discussion live on Tribe Family Channel for Season 3, Voices of Wisdom. My name is Beverly Black Johnson. Tribe Family Channel is created by myself, Gumbo for the Soul International, and produced by Bush Storage Media. You can find us on Twitter at Tribe Family US and at TribeFamilyChannel.com, and also GumboForTheSoul.com and BruceGeorgeMedia.com. Until next week, I'm sorry, we have a weekly show as well, but until next month, we wish you love, peace, and gumbo for the soul.
Thank you.
Tribe Family Channel. Tribe Family Channel. Oh.